This is KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You've reached Reality Sandwich. We are here today. I'm Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant, and you are listening to Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth. And as you know, we have a variety of guest topics and co-hosts, and today is our first day with Paul Gottlieb, who is, you've probably heard him on the show before, but today's his first day co-hosting, and he is an expert in plastics, sustainable living, and all sorts of other important environmental issues. And he has a website called mindfully.org. And today, our guest is Ignacio Chapella, who, if any of you have seen The Future of Food, he is interviewed extensively in that movie. It's a fascinating film. And he is the assistant professor of microbial ecology at the Department of Environmental Sciences at UC Berkeley. And he is the founder of the Mycological, I hope I said that right, facility in Oaxaca, which is dealing with the questions of natural resources and indigenous rights. And he is widely engaged in the role of biotechnology in our society, environment, and our economy. And so he's done some really wonderful work in Mexico, Costa Rica, and Ecuador on questions of access, ownership, and stewardship of genetic resources, and has served as advisor on various Latin American countries, as well as multilateral institutions such as the United Nations, the World Bank, and the International Organization for Chemical Sciences in Development. He was a member of the National Academy of Sciences Committee on the Environmental Impact of Commercializing the Transgenic Crops. So I'm going to have Paul introduce him a little bit further. First, I'd like to welcome you both here. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Julie.
Welcome, Ignacio.
Julie, hi.
Hi. So, Paul, this is definitely your area of expertise, so I wanted to give you just an opportunity to kind of introduce the topic, which we're going to be talking about, your food transformed. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about Ignacio and why you brought him on today and all that
Sure.
great stuff.
Sure. Yeah, I have been working with and to help Ignacio for a few years. He's a very good friend of mine. I just want to mention I'm also a member of the Sierra Club Genetic Engineering Committee, at national level. Well, yeah, today we'll talk about what this means to, what's it, genetically engineer some food. What does this mean to the viewers, I mean the audience listening, and what's happened in Ignacio's life over the past few years? What led him to this place that he's in today? And what does this mean to all of us? I mean, Ignacio sits in what some may call academia, which is a high place in society, and it means nothing to people who listen on the street. And I would like to bring that to all of us. This means very much. What's happening in academia? What's happening in the world of industry with genetic engineering, food, our lives is very important. Now, today, people in the U.S. have the world at their fingertips. Our supermarkets contain food from every continent. And if we don't have time to purchase our food at the store, then we just go online and order it, and it gets delivered like one big machine. So in spite of this abundance, this is my question to Ignacio, my first question. Are we not more removed from our food than at any time in history, in spite of all this convenience that we have?
Well, yeah, it's exactly what has been happening, especially in our culture where we seem to value very much the possibility of having everything all year round, anything possible. In our supermarkets, we seem to be really addicted to that, if that's possible. And what that means is that we are happy with transporting food. The average distance that a food item in your supermarket travels is about 2,000 miles. And we seem to be happy with that. What that means is really that we have removed ourselves from not only the way that food is produced, but also the landscapes with the people who live on those landscapes with the consequences of raising and producing that food have all been removed from our conscious being of everyday living, so that many things can happen behind the scenes, so to speak, behind the Sierra Nevada and the Rocky Mountains in the Midwest and so on, that we don't need to know about. How animals are treated, how the land, the soil, the water is treated, and the consequences of that are totally removed from our conscious every day.
So that's everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems that progress, as it's called, is taking quantum leaps, with new technologies sprouting so quickly that even scientists studying them cannot keep pace. I think all our listeners would acknowledge that their own lives have been touched by these new technologies. How would you say that this quantum shift is affecting our lives in terms of risk, dependency, and control, and that being control of our own lives?
Yeah, the question of control, I think, Paul, is really important here. And maybe we should make clear to the audience what it is that we're really talking about.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, what you mentioned as this quantum leap. And I think we are referring to what is properly referred to as transgenic manipulation, the transgenic manipulation of life. There are lots of ways in which we have manipulated life to produce food, to produce all kinds of things, flowers and so on.
Yeah, now this includes a number of words here. You say transgenic.
Yes.
Some people say genetically engineered. Some people say genetically modified. But these are
That's
all,
right.
We're referring to the same thing. But then industry also says, well, we've been genetically engineering things for millennia.
That's exactly right.
What's the difference here?
That's why I think we need to be really clear about what we mean. Because genetic engineering, it's true. You know, we have been manipulating life for at least 10, 15,000 years to come up with the crops that we, you know, that grow everywhere and that are so productive and so useful. And so using the term genetic engineering or genetic manipulation can be very confusing.
So what is it?
What we're talking about is this thing that I use the word transgenic manipulation, in which you can or we can now bring out DNA, that is the heritable material that every living cell has within it. We can take that DNA from one organism and transfer it, transgenicize another organism. Beyond the normal boundaries of sexual recombination or sexual mixing, normally we exchange DNA between ourselves, humans, you know, by having sex and having children, and plants through pollination and all kinds of organisms are usually exchanging genes, exchanging DNA. But with a transgenic manipulation, what we can now do is exchange that DNA beyond the point of sexual compatibility. So, for example, we can bring DNA from a bacterium into a plant, from an animal into a plant, from a human being into a corn plant, and vice versa, in any direction that we wish. That opens a whole new, that's why I think you're right in calling it a quantum leap, a whole new scene over which we are beginning to put our hands onto that we didn't have before the 1970s. It's really, really recent, and it's very dramatic in that it's really manipulating evolution itself.
Well, our food's regulated by the FDA. That's the Food and Drug Administration, and some of it even the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. And they're charged with regulating, you know, different aspects of it. Transnational corporations such as Monsanto tell us that genetically engineered crops are the most regulated food in history. And, you know, as if hit by deja vu, the FDA and EPA echo those same words. Is anybody really looking at this?
Well, the sad reality is that all these products, all these manipulations that are so important have never been tested properly.
What?
For safety.
None?
Well, it is true. It is true. There have been...
I'm playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, no, let me just put it to people out there that what this... If I produce a transgenic plant, what I do is I request from USDA, that this plant be deregulated.
Deregulated,
which means it all the possibilities of observing this plant with under a special light or with special attention are removed. And the way I request USDA to do that is I just tell them what I did, tell them that I have a plant that seems to look right, and provide them with any information I might wish to give them about the safety of this. If I decide to run an experiment that, you know, to test whether it's nutritious or not, that's fine, and I can give them that information. If I don't want to do that, I don't need to. It's totally voluntary.
So you as a corporation, you decide what you're going to give the government.
That's right.
Not the government saying to you,
you have to give
have
me
to.
That. No, I just decide what I give them. And the government has always been happy with just deregulating this plant. So these organisms are just released with no further regulation, with no further questions asked. They are not tested either by the Food and Drug Administration. And there is no way of finding out what they know, because even the information that the industry provides is kept under what's called CBI, confidential business information, that nobody has access to. It's kind of secret information that they retain. So there is no transparency, there is no public oversight, there is not even testing of these organisms, and they are released over huge areas of our public landscape. At least 100,000 acres are planted every year to transgenic crops, and very few people even know about it.
So, what's the greatest crop? What's the crop with the greatest amount of acreage? Is that corn?
Corn. Though there is such a large acreage, there are very few crops that are transformed right now, transgenically transformed. There's corn, canola, cotton, soybeans.
Those are important ones, though. See, especially corn.
Yes, of course. They're very, very important and very widespread and worldwide important. That's why they introduced them initially.
But also, yes, it's widespread as far as being planted in many places, but for the person who's listening now, corn is a very large part of the processed foods, the soda, the chips they buy. You know, all of these things they're sweetened with corn sweetener.
Yes, so, I mean, corn protein, corn starch, corn sweeteners, all kinds of products have corn. In fact, approximately 70, depending on what you eat and where you buy, but about 70% of what we eat in the U.S. in some way or another has these materials. And between soybeans, which are used a lot for protein, even in things like tofu and, you know, other vegetarian meals, and corn, between soybeans and corn, up to 80% of what we eat will carry a trace of transgenic manipulation.
And those go to the livestock that they feed the cattle and the animals that we eat, too. Is that correct?
That's right.
And do we know anything about how that might affect people once they then consume those animals?
You know, the honest answer by a scientist, I think, the only honest answer is no, we don't know. There has been so little studied about the consequences of these things that I think the honest answer is to say no. The very few studies that have been done really make me pause about the safety of these things. You will hear people saying, well, but I'm not seeing anybody, you know, falling dead from eating these things, or
right.
I'm not seeing any consequences. But the reality is that we would not know. If you can imagine, okay, what would we see if, you know, 30% of the people who ingested these things develop some kind of, you know, nutritional, hormonal, long-term problem? Would we be able to see it? And the answer is no, because we're not looking. There is no labeling required for these things. So there is no way of comparing and doing an epidemiological study that would tell us whether, in fact, there is an effect or not. So we're just really driving into this totally blind.
I would like to just say that this is not just a matter of not knowing. It's a matter of intentionally, let's say, not asking the right questions so that you don't get those difficult answers.
That's right.
If you're Monsanto, you don't want to ask the difficult questions that might make your product look bad.
Yeah, that's correct. And unfortunately, it has been so that anybody who asks those questions and finds the answers and finds, you know, that the answers are not that happy, has received incredible pressure and trouble, to the extent that at this point it has been really a one question, one person. One scientist loses his job or her job and loses his position or his ability, her ability to raise money to continue doing that research.
And this has happened to you.
Yeah, yeah, I'm one of those.
Your graduate student, David Quist, was in Oaxaca, in the highlands of Oaxaca, and he was, tell us about this. What was he doing there?
Well, we were looking, we were preparing, we were collaborating, working with a group of indigenous communities there in the Sierra Norte of Oaxaca, with whom we had collaborated over many, many years. At that point, we were thinking, we had been already talking about this for a few years and thinking, you know, these products, mostly being produced in the U.S., there's nobody who is going to tell you when they arrive here. By the way, they were illegal. They are illegal in Mexico.
To grow them.
To grow them, yes. And people were really worried about them being planted or arriving there as contaminants, you know, without people knowing. So we would ask the question, who is going to be there to tell you when they arrive or if they represent a problem? And you go through the list. You say, well, industry, of course, is never going to tell you because they have the business priority. Government is not going to tell you because they, as you, Paul, said already, the government in the U.S. and by consequence the government in many other countries decided not to ask it these questions. We're not going to look. Then academia is not going to tell you because it's, as we're finding out, it's really expensive to even ask these questions in terms of career and
your
privileges.
Your career.
Yeah. And so then when you look at it, the only people who can really find out, who can really ask the question, are the consumers or the producers, you know, small organic farmers or small farmers who have the interest to do it. So what we were doing back then was helping them set up the technical capacity to do this testing. To do that, you have to, you know, behave as though you were expecting them to be there. But it was just a dry run, we thought we were not going to find them. We were just preparing to be technically able to do it. The surprise came when David Quist was running this training workshop, and he started finding that the samples that were supposed to be negative controls were showing up positive.
Wow.
What's a negative control?
A negative control is what you use to make sure that your test says no when it has to say no. So, you know, you put in a sample that is clean, that is not contaminated, that you know it's solidly negative, and it has to tell you it's negative. And these samples started showing positive.
And those samples were the actual maize from corn?
Yes, these were seed samples from what's called criollo, or land races of corn, that grows in these small plots that are maintained, have been maintained over the centuries by small family farmers in these regions. Those, we thought, you know, that's going to be the cleanest, the most pristine type of corn that you could even imagine, because this is where corn was domesticated for the first time about 10,000 years ago. This is where most of the diversity of corn for the world is maintained. We thought, you know, the best negative control.
It's in a remote area.
It is remote. It is far away in the mountains and certainly, at least legally, thousands of miles away from the nearest legal commercial plot of transgenic.
Wow. When I saw the movie, that was really, really upsetting to me to see that. Because one of the things they describe is that the less diversity you have among strains of, say, corn, for example, the more chance that if something happens to a crop, for instance, a mold or a drought or something, that you could wipe out a big portion of the supply. And then to find that all of these, are there thousands of strains of different types of corn in Mexico?
Yes.
And that now with this cross-pollination, these indigenous and native corns could be really wiped out. And that was really, really, that was really difficult for me to swallow.
Yeah.
What do you think? Maybe explain how did they now get tainted? What was the process that took these corn that you thought were going to be pure, and how did you find this gene? What happened?
How did it get there?
Yeah.
What happened to contaminate this corn?
Yeah. Well, it's a tragic vicious circle, I believe. Let me start here with my tax dollars. You know, this is about the right time of year to be talking about taxes. And when you look at where your tax dollars go, a good amount of it goes to agricultural subsidies in the U.S. in such a way that we can maintain those monocultures, great big industrial size fields in the Midwest that produce corn at below production costs. In some cases, that corn goes out with up to 30% of subsidy cost below production cost. So we have a glut that we produce under very, very unsustainable environmental conditions, social conditions. All these families, farming families, are disappearing and committing suicide. You know, it's a really terrible tragedy to maintain this high productivity at low cost. That corn goes into the international markets and at low cost. So then that is considered to be more competitive. Even in places like Mexico, which is a country of corn, they flood the country with cheap corn from the U.S. In that year that we were working at a rate of about 5 to 6 million tons of corn from the U.S. were being imported into Mexico, 30 to 40% of which is transgenic. So the seed, which they call grain, and it arrives unlabeled with 30 to 40% of the seed mixed in that is transgenic. Now, they call it grain because here in the U.S., you do have a difference between seed and grain, where grain is something that will be eaten, will be consumed, not planted, and the seed is something that you plant. But if you go to the place where people live off the land and where people are used to keep those seeds going, because that's what they've been doing for centuries, there's no difference between grain and seed. Mm-hmm. And so these seeds, grains, flood the country. They get distributed through a welfare system, a very effective and subsidized, again, welfare system that distributes the seed even to the most remote villages. So you have, great big containers of transgenic seed readily available to anybody who will buy it at a cheap cost.
And that's not considered illegal because it's not being supposed to be planted. It's only illegal to plant.
That's right.
Wow.
It's not considered illegal because, it would be the farmer or it would be the campesino who is breaking the law.
Ugh.
And at some point, when we discovered the contamination, some Mexican officials were saying, well, we're going to start finding who did it. We're going to put them in jail, make sure that they never produce corn ever again. They were proposing coming in and destroying whole areas of milpa plantations and so on. Fortunately, we managed to, dissuade them from that response, dissuade the government from that response. But that's where they were trying to put the blame on.
They were trying to blame the farmer.
But the blame here really belongs with the U.S. government, doesn't it? I mean, USAID.
Well, I think this is something that's really ripe for a court to look into.
Tell us about this. Didn't most of this come in through donations from the U.S. government?
Well, that's what's happening in Africa.
That's
what's happening in places where there's real famine. And a lot of the USAID, that the big sacks of corn that has the big USAID logo on it, comes mixed with transgenic. This has really become perverse over the years since we made that discovery. At this point, it seems to be a real policy of State Department to make sure that they are introducing transgenic seed that is plantable, that will be planted. Because what many African countries were saying was, you really have to try and help us avoid that contamination, what happened in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to do it would be to mill it. to make sure that nobody will plant it. Mm-hmm. You know, the seed is dead.
Right.
And there were some European countries who were willing to put the money up for milling, and the U.S. government said, no way, we're going to deliver seed.
So is there, in your opinion, a reason, a strategy behind why they're insisting on getting the actual seed? Is there, you know, is there a more sinister potential reason behind this, a corporate kind of greed?
Well, unfortunately, I will sound conspirational. I know that these days it's anybody who says, you know, anything that sounds conspirational will say, oh, yeah, you know, conspiracy theory, it's always wrong, it's always wrong. But on in this case, I'm afraid that there is a lot of design. There is a lot of, you know, forethought and planning about this that on the contamination front, I don't think was intended initially. But once it's there, I've heard officials, and I've also heard quotes from officials who have said, you know, that's what we need now. We just need to press on, make sure that the contamination gets, you know, gets a hold, especially in Africa, in Asia, Latin America, so that it will be a fait accompli, something that people cannot complain about.
They have no choice.
Yeah, they will have no choice.
Wow.
So it's something that I think it is clearly thought out. The other thing that we have to remember, I think, Paul, you were hinting at it at the beginning when you said, we decided not to look. We decided to go ahead with this. It was a very clear decision of the first Bush, the Bush Quail administration, to go ahead with this as the technology. They call it a technology, and they said this is what's going to replace computer technology, information technology, once it goes away from Silicon Valley and the U.S. We need an engine for the economy of the U.S. and the world, and that engine is going to be biotechnology. So at that point, it became national interest. It became a matter for State Department to deal with, not agriculture, not economy, state. And it continues to be a central policy, a central governmental policy to promote these things. For example, the laws that have been produced, for national security and anti-terrorism laws, they all have some clause that includes the promotion of transgenic organisms.
Yeah.
The laws that were left in Iraq, for example, by the Bremer administration, one of the most important ones, forbids the farmers from planting their own seed.
That's Order 81.
That's exactly Order 81. You might be able to tell us more about that, but it puts that hook on as a matter of national policy.
This reminds me of when I saw the movie The Corporation, about privatizing water and you know, contaminating the water so that then people have to buy water from a corporation. So people can't even live without paying somebody. They can't even get water. They can't even grow their own food. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the patenting of life, because I thought this was pretty interesting, how it was always illegal to do that. And then based on some loophole, this is now allowed. And I think that this might help sort of set the foundation for people to understand, you know, once you can patent life, you have control over that seed, you have control over the money, you have control over the farmers, and you have control over the people, because they can't even grow food and have water to survive if you have to pay a corporation to even have the seed.
I'll add one little caveat to that is, now, how can a U.S. patent affect people in Mexico or Africa? How can this happen? What, you mean, do the whole thing and talk about the whole thing.
Yeah, well, that obviously is the point of connection between all these, because when you look at the contamination problem, it turns out that these crops do not provide any real advantage, especially in the developing world. You know, these crops have been designed for the Midwest to deal with problems in the Midwest, and they are, you know, so-so.
Big machines.
Depending on who you ask, a transgenic corn might do a little better, like 5% better than a normal hybrid corn. Sometimes they do 20% worse.
Mm.
So it's not a great big advantage. What they thought they were going to do was to provide this great big advantage. There was going to be more productivity, less chemicals, less pests, and so on and so forth. That really hasn't panned out. What did happen, though, is that through the contamination, what happens is that you get the equivalent of, you know, the brand that is used to label cattle. Mm. You know, you brand your cattle when it's born, and you know, whenever you see that label, that brand, you know that cattle belongs to you. Nobody can claim it for them. This transgenic manipulation, what it has ended up being really is like a molecular brand, where every cell that carries that piece of DNA can be detected as the ownership of someone else. So the transgenic manipulation at this point, in my view, the most important thing is simply establishing that relationship of ownership in which I am the owner and you're not. You're the user, you're the consumer, I'm the producer, I'm the owner. So it establishes this totally new type of relationship between human beings over the organism, over living things. And, of course, the patent system has been used as a tool to facilitate this relationship, to enforce it, to make it legally enforceable. The patents are different in each country, as you, Paul, were hinting at.
Each country has
a patent office, each country has a patent system, and so on. But through the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs and the TRIPS,
that's
part of that.
GATT, TRIPS?
Yes, the trade-related intellectual property matters within GATT. The whole drive has been to compatibilize and make all these countries line up in some kind of global enforcement mechanism through which a patent in a country will be honored and recognized by the patent offices in the other countries and so on, so you can enforce these patents. That was spearheaded mostly by the software industry, by the computer industry and so on, fighting pirated music information. And the biotechnology industry simply carbon copied from that experience and decided now living things are like computers and their DNA is like the programming within them.
I think the scariest part about that the challenge is not a black and white issue. And if it were, let's say, like a cattle where the cow came, you know, the cow was born and then you branded it, that'd be one thing. But every cow after that now has this sort of genetic brand, and every species, you know, every offspring down the line is also now owned by that. That would be sort of the analogy. So the challenge that is with plant life is that when it cross-pollinates, you have no control over it. And even if, in fact, I think there should be a lawsuit if you're an organic farm or something, shouldn't you be able to say sue Monsanto for now contaminating your corn? Mm-hmm. But instead they're saying, well, your gene is now in my corn and now I have the rights over your corn and your farm. Yeah.
The thief is the one who is protected and the innocent is prosecuted.
Well, it is tragic, but that's what you're just describing, Julie, is exactly what's been happening both in Canada as well as in the U.S., where these questions have been tested. And only last year, a very important decision was reached by the Supreme Court of Canada, where
Percy Schmeiser.
Yeah, there is a farmer by the name of Percy Schmeiser, who is also covered in that movie, The Future of Food.
Oh, yes. That was a terrible story.
It is a terrible story, and it's really the worldwide precedent that establishes that exactly what you said. If my cow with a molecular brand ends up in your field, then you have to pay because you stole that cow, basically. It's really weird. It's really contradictory with anything that reason or morality really would imply. And some of the contradictions are, for example, you can imagine that these things operate like, if you do the analogy with computers, which we really should be careful about what metaphors we use, you know, and talking about living things like machines is not a good idea.
No.
But if we go there for a second, this is the equivalent of having, you know, viruses programs mm-hmm. that just are sticky and move around and go into your computer. And then having somebody coming to your office or to your studio here and saying, oh, that computer over there belongs to me because it carries my virus.
Mm-hmm.
It carries my program. And it's just a tiny little thing that, you know, you have all these other files and all this other information, all these other things that you have that make up your computer and your information, your computer. Well, these people can come in and claim ownership over everything
mm-hmm.
in your computer just because your computer received,
right.
without you wanting it,
right.
their virus.
That's essentially what they did to Percy.
Mm-hmm.
Percy Schmeiser. He's in Saskatchewan. He's a canola farmer. Up there they call it rapeseed. And he's another friend of mine. When I first heard about this, I couldn't believe it. But then, sorry, not speaking into the mic. It's just inconceivable that first he would be prosecuted by Monsanto in the federal court of Canada, lose the case, lose his appeal, and then lose the case in the Supreme Court. It's absurd, is what it is to me.
It makes no sense. I don't think it makes sense to any clear thinking human being. And I think this is where you then have to ask the questions: how could this happen? What is going on? And then the question becomes: is there any back and forth between government officials and corporate executives in these companies? Is there some stake between the two? Why would we make government policy to support and protect these corporations when it does not even seem to make logical sense? And then I don't know if you know any information on this, but I don't know any details, but I have heard that there are people from Monsanto, that there's like a revolving door between Monsanto and the USDA or something, making this policy in favor of these corporations. And this is, I think, where the big problem lies.
Entirely.
There's so many of these people. I saw an article in a newspaper, and they said that there's so many people who are doing this that they can't have an article big enough. There's just hundreds of these people. They go from Monsanto into the USDA, FDA, EPA. The EPA is gone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all of these organizations, they're gone as far as I'm concerned. They do nothing because they are under the control, the direct control of corporations like Monsanto.
Yeah, I think it's gone
worse.
It's gone so far that I think it's impossible to distinguish even between one and the other. You know, it used to be that, there used to be corruption, you know, that there used to be influence
mm-hmm.
because there's lobbying. And we can talk about, you know, the enormous amount of money and people in Washington, D.C. dedicated to convince Congress people to vote one way or the other, pass these laws and enforce these laws in such and such a way, the Supreme Court and so on. It used to be that there was that. It used to be that there was, you know, payoffs on the side, that type of thing. I'm sure it's still happening. But the tragic thing of our decade is that now there is just not even the influence. They have become indistinguishable. Because of this revolving door, you know, the Secretary for Agriculture, the Attorney General, the prior Attorney General, they all have not only vested interests commercially, stock and so on, they have been part of the industry and they go back and forth. So what it ends up being is they come out of industry, write some law, make sure that they know the loopholes, they become the experts on that law,
mm-hmm.
they go back to industry to advise the industry on how to deal with that law that they just wrote.
Right.
So I think the really big tragedy of our decade is that it's not industry influencing government, but that government has become undistinguishable from industry.
And isn't
yes.
it the same way in the universities?
And that is also the tragedy, that universities used to be influenced by commercial interests.
I mean, I used to see a university, you know, this big thing, go and get a PhD, become a doctor, and you get this pure knowledge. You deal with truth. I mean, that's what I grew up with. That you would find truth at the university, and I don't think you find that there anymore.
Well, only if you are looking for the right kind of truth. There are some truths that are not allowed anymore. And that's mostly because I think the same process that we were talking about, government, has happened at university. Mm-hmm. Berkeley itself, you know, the paragon of the public university worldwide, has totally taken over.
You protested. You are very much in favor of academic freedom, and you are against the connections between industry and research at the university, and this came down to bear very hard on you. I mean, you were against, was it Novartis, giving money to research at UC Berkeley for genetic engineering?
Yeah, it's not just the giving money. You know, it would be fine if they gave money to a university that was untainted by that. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that, this is a good example. There was this proposal that actually passed in the end after a lot of battling to bring a $50 million relationship between Novartis and the university at Berkeley. And the money that goes into research does influence what people do, the decisions that, you know, what you set a student to ask and not ask and so on. But more importantly, what they got for that money was positions within really key committees that decide on the policy for the whole university. Who gets hired? Who doesn't get hired? What students, what type of student comes in? What type of programs, what type of classes are taught?
So what happened to you for speaking up? You. Exactly.
Yeah, I just wanted to end by saying that it seems to me that together with the transgenic manipulation, with the physical manipulation of living things, we have also seen the transformation of our institutions. Mm-hmm. We have allowed ourselves to, or we've allowed our institutions to be internally transformed in their structure, in their very essence, in their very being, to accommodate for these developments.
Right. Like you said, if it were just even tainting one study, there's a tragedy in that, but not so much. But if you're changing the policy of the entire university and the staff and the decisions and the thought process and the organization as a whole, you're basically buying control over the university.
Exactly.
That's very scary.
So we've lost control, and on this I think I'm talking about public. You know, there are people who have some control, but we as the public, I think we have lost control over how things are produced, what grows, what doesn't grow, what gets to my plate, what doesn't. And we have also lost control of our capacity to provide a reasonable or a recent answer to those problems.
Is it safe? That kind of a question.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I just divide research just for simplicity's sake. I say, okay, there is promotional research, the people who are in the RARA team, you know, the cheerleaders who say, we want more. Great. It's great that somebody's thinking about that and developing those things. But do we have anybody on the other team of the precautionary research?
What kind of a proportion do you think? How many pro and how many con?
Okay, I have a student who is trying to come up with that type of number, but I can give you just an anecdote. That discovery of the contamination of corn in Mexico was literally $2,000 from another research project that I dumped into it. That's how much money we put into it. At the same time, we were confronting that $50 million as simply a part of the budget of, it was one-third of the research budget for that department that is just totally dedicated to promote these things, not only from the point of view of research and teaching, but also from the extension. You know, the university has become a propaganda machine. Mm. With people who are full-time paid by taxpayer dollars to go around California and the world telling people, this is what we want, this is what we want, this is what we want, as a mantra, mm-hmm. for no reason whatsoever. So it's really deep in the structure of our institutions.
Okay, what does this mean to me on the street? Yeah, I mean, we'll have to wrap this up, but what does this mean to me on the street? I mean, you in the ivory tower, tell me, how does this affect me? Your job is on the line right now because you are speaking the truth. You are speaking up for justice. How does this affect me if you don't get your job? I don't care. What does this mean?
That's right. Yeah, academia represents the only place. The only place, when you think of it, there is the artists who are always under pressure from lack of money. There are places like this radio station where some thinking and some discussion can happen. But we have to admit to it, it's the public spaces where we can think, discuss, ask questions, and have the resources to find the answers, no matter how painful. We don't have any, apart from the public university. And seeing that university taken over by such blind, short-sighted, one-sided, minority interests is a tragedy that I think the public should take so seriously, because what's being taken away from them is the possibility of even asking the questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's happening with media, you know? That you, there, it's not the news that you see, it's the news that you don't see.
Right.
Could you offer any kind of word on hope?
That's exactly what I was going to ask. So
go ahead.
People always, boy, we could talk for hours on how tragic this is. But, you know, there becomes a point where people shut off because it's so scary and it's so upsetting and they feel so powerless. So what are some things that people can do?
Now, there are lots of things going on. And I'm sorry if this sounds like, too negative.
It's
because
just the facts.
it's
facts, not you.
But we are not talking about a whole bunch of facts that are happening that have to do with this tragedy. I think what's happening right now, not only in the U.S. but around the world, is that people are really waking up on the bite of the economy, because the economy is coming to bite us.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to it's going to get much worse, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people know that, you know, in your pocketbook, in your bank account, and so on. So under that pressure, I think people are really, really discovering that we've been asleep.
Mm-hmm.
At least since the New Deal. The New Deal was so great and so wonderful, and we all had this feeling that there was big government to look after us. There was somebody was dealing with those questions, or the university, or somebody else was dealing. And I think people are just realizing that's not true. So there are all these new spaces being created outside the university, outside government, to provide governance, to provide responses. There are all these new organizations coming up, new foundations coming up. People are taking the situation in their hands when they realize that there is no government to look after them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, really, really hopeful. I think my feeling, at least in the GMO front, is that we have gone over the brow of the hill from a time when nobody even cared. Nobody knew about it, and even when they knew, they didn't care about these things, to a time now when, you know, we have much larger groups of people who become interested and say, oh my God, we really need to take the situation in our hands. On the GMO front, there are hundreds, literally hundreds of regions around the world, mostly in Europe, but it's also happening in Latin America. It's happening here with a GMO-free county movement, for example. Lots of regions where people are saying, you know what, federal government might want to say whatever they want. EU government, European Union government might want to say whatever they want. Federal governments and national governments in all these developing countries might say whatever they want. We don't want it. And they say it loud and clear.
Mm.
They establish systems of food production, food distribution, information sharing, and so on, that are really taking off and are totally out of control, happily enough. You know, it's so difficult to control that. We've seen that here in California, and it's really exciting to see it happen.
That's great. Well, I just want to wrap it up. Is there a place, you know, and I forgot to take calls on the air. I'm sorry for everybody that wanted to call in. If you have questions, you can always email me, or I don't know if there's any contact number for you, just in general, as far as how people can find out more about this or your cause or anything.
Well, my email, I'm fine with giving that out. I'm still working for a public university, and it's not hard to find, and it's ICHAPELA, so iChapella, no doubles anywhere, at nature.berkeley.edu. But if you just want to do the voyeuristic thing and come to a website, on my case, you can look at tenuredjustice.org. That's more or less up to date. tenurejustice.org. And on GMO questions, I still like very much the Pesticide Action Network website, which is panna.org.
You're on the board.
Panna.org. I am on the board of that. Mm-hmm. Paul's website is very good on that, too. He keeps that very well updated.
Mindfully.org. That's MindFully.org.
That's right.
And you're also on, you're on one other board. I know we have to wrap it up. CRG?
I used to be in the board of the Council for Responsible Genetics.
Okay.
I'm not in there anymore.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. This was just a wonderful conversation.
Julie, thank you very much.
Yeah, since I saw the Future of Food, I've been telling everybody about it, and so thank you for all of your work.
Thank you.
On that Future of Food, I'm organizing a showing in the East Bay.
Oh, great.
Coming up, not this coming month, but possibly the next. But
okay.
They can contact me through mindfully.org to find out details.
Great.
There are showings of Future of Food also with a panel afterwards with the director, and I'm going to be on that, and somebody else perhaps. And in Sacramento and in Davis, coming up the last day of March and first day of April.
Maybe
great.
It could be at ours.
Sounds good. Okay, thank you for listening. Stay tuned next week.
Was your woman and you were my man. You have no other woman, you'd be weak as a lamb. If you had the strength to walk out my door, my love would overrule my sins, and I'd call you back for more. If I was your woman, if I was your woman, and you were my.